Okay, I call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 2076.
First witness.
Our first witness is Mitch.
Okay.
And I welcome our first witness, Chair Greenlich, for the record. Could you please tell us who you are?
Except to which I know who I am.
Can we make him swear an oath just in case?
You have to vote on this? Representative Mitch Greenlich, House District 33, and thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me. It turns out, for those of you who are here to testify on House Bill 2076, that it's been pointed out to me that this is the wrong version. So there will be an amendment coming that will put this bill back where it's supposed to be. This is a bill that's been in play for about four sessions. And when I asked to pick up an old one, what was picked up was a version that the Senate amended to essentially kill the concept. So the bill, as it now reads, has a set of requirements of hospitals and health plans and other organizations with personal health data. And then it says in each of the sections that if the organization is compliant with HIPAA regulations, federal HIPAA regulations, it doesn't have to do what the bill wants it to do, which is not exactly what I have in mind. So I'll introduce the bill as it's intended, the mythical bill, which does not have in it, for the record, page 3, line 37 through 42, and on page 2, line 39 through 44. Those will not be in it. It'll also make clear the following. The bill is really a very simple bill. It's a bill that comes from my experience as a corporate officer in a healthcare program, Kaiser Permanente. And the one thing that I always knew as a healthcare manager, something you wouldn't recognize, but that's when the boss calls you in, you pay attention to that. And what this bill is intended to do is to get the CEO of organizations that maintain personal health data to certify that they have reviewed the data security system for personal health data, that they have personally reviewed that and are willing to stand by its security for the personal health care records. We've had too many experiences, and I can list lots of examples, but too many experiences where personal health care data went missing. One case, one of the healthcare providers in Portland decided the safest way to deal with personal healthcare data was to put it on a PC and have somebody drive it home. So you can imagine how long it took for somebody to break into that car, steal the PC that thousands of healthcare records were on, and take off. And it turns out no harm came of that, but there were a lot of expenses and severe problems around it. It also would require the CEO to certify that if there had been any breaches in the system, that they would confidentially have notified their auditors and their board that there were breaches in the system. Not in public, just confidentially, and what they had done to secure the data. So it's an attempt to provide one extra layer of security. More and more of our data are being put into electronic systems, and they are, as we've heard, the Chinese government is hacking the U.S. Defense Department. I mean, there's just so much of this going on that it just seems to me it's a useful, it will be a useful addition to add this one layer, to make sure the CEOs are on top of it, that they've talked to their data security people, they've gotten reports, and that if there have been any breaches, that those breaches are reported to their auditors and to their board. I've talked to you, almost speaking back as the chair rather than as a testifier, but I've invited people to testify today, knowing the version of the bill will change, but to give their perspective on what their opinion might be. I've also promised that when we get an amendment, I'll bring the bill back up for a hearing and give them another chance to comment on it. I've also agreed to try and create an informational meeting on HIPAA and results, bringing some people in that are experts on HIPAA procedures guarding data. So with that, I'll stop and answer any questions you have, and then I'll come back and rack havoc from over there.
Representative Weider.
Thank you. Just real quick, I'm a little nervous on this, Mitch, Representative Greenlick, just because I'm sitting here.
I'm just an humble witness.
Well, my humble witness before me at this moment. If we're not opening a can of worms here a little bit, because what if the state somehow, if somebody gets into the state system and releases information about HIPAA files, things like that, because I know of one company that was given records and they had some HIPAA information into it. This company actually had given it back and let them know that it happened, but would the governor be liable at that point?
Or is the state, because
usually, yeah, because as a CEO or the head of a company, usually the company is responsible for it. So we're saying the company and the CEO are responsible, and I understand. Is that what you're wanting to do?
This doesn't change responsibility. This simply adds, I mean, HIPAA violations are covered in the U.S. code pretty specifically, including what the fines are for violation of HIPAA. What this does is simply add another layer of security above HIPAA. But I would say if it were state data, it would be the state agency director that would be the equivalent of the CEO, although it's not included in this bill. So I'd imagine it would be Dr. Goldberg if it was a health authority breach, and that he would be responsible for dealing with it, or it might be Mel Cohen, who's responsible for the public health data, which is where the interesting. I think I intend to have a separate amendment to this to add CCOs to it to see if we all, if we think the thing is a good idea, do we also think CCOs ought to have the same responsibility, because they are going to have, they're going to be at least a pseudo insurance company and will have lots of data. But no, I would be happy for an amendment that would make the governor personally responsible for health care.
Wouldn't this be ultimate?
Might not pass veto.
He's the ultimate over all of it. So.
That might not make it veto proof.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, what are your thoughts on having this be the Chief Information Officer, CIO, instead of the CEO? Have you considered this? Because we're talking about data, and I'm not proposing this right now, but I'm wondering if you've gone down this path and already thought it through and decided that CEO is more perfectly aligned with your intent.
No, my assumption is the CEO would call in the CIO and tell me what you need to tell me to convince me that I can sign this report. So it would be the CIO that would be, I would assume, making that presentation. That's the what I suggested. Things happen when the boss calls them in, and this happened, I would imagine the CIO would be well prepared to convince the boss that everything was fine.
Follow up?
Please.
Thanks. And you're looking to have, as someone taking personal responsibility as far up the chain as possible, correct?
Yeah. I think this will highlight the CEO's responsibility, CIO's responsibility, when he's called annually to his boss's office and says, I got to sign this form. Will you convince me? Have we had any problems last year? Have there been any breaches? If there were, what have you done to correct them? I mean, those are the kind of that's the what I imagine is a discussion between the CEO and the CIO getting ready to fill out this form. And that's a discussion that might not otherwise happen from year to year. It's to foster that discussion. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of this bill.
You may not know the answer to this, but in a case of, yeah, of a HIPAA violation in an organization, the laptop story or whatever, doesn't HIPAA dump responsibility on somebody in charge?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I mean, it may be simply that the employee causing the breach is the end of the line, but it seems like that must flow uphill to somebody in a position of responsibility, and I don't know what happens then, if they go to jail or we whip them or what, but, you know, I guess I'm kind of asking the question, does HIPAA already cover this in the front end, or are we defining HIPAA additionally here in Oregon?
Our health council has agreed to become somewhat of an expert on 42 U.S.C. 1320D2, which she did not claim to be an expert on as of an hour ago.
Okay.
So I expect she's watching what we're doing here, and that would be one of the questions that would be useful to find out. That'd be very useful to find out. I mean, if HIPAA really does do what I'm trying to do, then we don't need this bill. Yeah. My suspicion is HIPAA may not.
Yeah, my point is probably just the other side of that. If HIPAA has any teeth in it, in its design, then a HIPAA violation is going to result in somebody in a position of responsibility, I would hope, getting nailed. I don't know how that happens, but if there's a big HIPAA violation on loss of a laptop, I'd be very disappointed to hear that, so what? Nothing's going to happen, you know? So there must be some mechanism in there that says, that spells out what's going to happen.
Madam Chair, Representative Thompson, I think the point you make, I want to comment on, this is not intended to nail somebody's ass to the wall. This is really, and in fact, there aren't the kind of penalties that would be there. This is intended as a preventive measure to get that conversation that Representative Harker and I were talking about to take place and to certify it. That's all the purpose. This is a very benign bill, I think, although several CEOs don't think it is.
Right.
Representative, I have a question for you, too. Are any other states doing anything like this?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I haven't heard of any.
Any
we
other?
We could be first with this, like with the bottle bill.
Any other questions? Thank you. I'd like to call our next testifier, David Schlachtis.
Now the fun begins.
Throwing over the traces.
And Ian.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Hope Orthopedics of Oregon, just down the street here. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this bill. Before I get going, Representative Thompson, I wanted to address your question specifically. I do have an answer for you. As you all know, HIPAA guidelines are very complete. The bill has been in practice since 1996, and within those specific federal guidelines, there is what's called a chief privacy officer and a chief security officer, and every organization has to designate one within their organization. The chief privacy officer is the person that is responsible for ensuring the confidentiality of all the information, so the actual physical information. So if someone were to walk into a hospital, an ASC, a physician's office, they're not supposed to hear that someone is here for a specific reason. I won't get into the technicalities of it, but there's all sorts of situations where you can see somewhat confidential information, but if you can't attach a name to a specific situation, then it's not a violation. So if I just see that you're coming into my clinic, that is not necessarily a breach. If I see that you're coming into the clinic because you're going to have someone examine your knee, then that is potentially a breach. Then there's the chief security officer, and that person is ultimately responsible for the security of the information. Basically, you're talking about the computer systems. And if you don't have a computer system, if you're still a small medical group, then what you're talking about is the actual paper charts. So that's where the definition is within the law. We understand and support, obviously, HIPAA, and there actually is a second bill that was passed, I believe it was last year, by the feds called HITECH. And HITECH is responsible, makes us, it provides guidelines for us with regard to electronic medical records, electronic health records. So we have two layers of federal regulations now that govern us with regard to all of the things that we do to keep all of our patients' information completely confidential. Because of that, we feel that this this proposed bill, frankly, is duplicative. There are so many federal regulations out there. We all have to comply with those federal regulations. I can't speak for every ASC in the state, but I know our ASC complies completely. I can also tell you that ASCs are small in nature, so that question about does the CEO know what's going on, the answer is yes. You know, we have 44 employees, so when there's a HIPAA breach, when there's a near breach, I get told exactly that that's going on. We are, I believe, the fifth largest ASC in the state with 44 employees. So even my colleagues who run Bend Surgery Center and Southern Oregon Surgery Center, which might have 100 employees, I guarantee you, and I could name their names, that those CEOs know what's going on with regard to breaches within their organizations. The other thing that is a little concerning about this, and while it's well-intentioned and we support HIPAA completely, we are asking for another layer of administrative work. And so there's going to be a whole another layer of administrative work on the part of ASCs and an entire layer of work on the part of the Oregon legislature, or at least an agency in Oregon, at a time when we are trying to create less expensive systems. Integrated care, CCOs, we're trying to drive the cost down. All this is going to do is create more administrative work and drive our costs up. So the last thing that I want to say, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague from the Hospital Association, I know that Chair Greenlick had talked about having some type of informational hearing when we can talk all about HIPAA and what are those specific rules. We would love to participate. We'd love to come here and bring some additional people and resources to make sure that all of you understand the rules as they pertain to us, how we comply with those rules, why they're so important, how we take them seriously, so that it would give all of you a level of confidence that within the state of Oregon, we are all taking this seriously, and we're all doing our very best to ensure that there aren't any breaches in security. Not that you can protect against every single situation, we know we can't, but what I think you would want to know is, are you guys taking this seriously? What are you doing to make sure that this doesn't happen? And if it does, what do you do in response to that?
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. Do you fill out many forms in your work?
All the time.
How many forms do you suppose you fill out in a year?
Well, my carpal tunnel disease, I honestly don't know.
So if you fill 500, if you would now have to fill 501, would that be a major increase in expense to your organization?
Chair Greenlick, when I read the regulations as they're written, my concern is that it's not just a, did you do anything to, you know, are you aware of the violations, yes or no, I can sign my name to it. Typically, the forms that come out of the state and the feds require a whole lot of work and a whole lot of time and effort to gather data, find all the additional dates, put dates and locations and all that information. And that's where our concern is, that it won't be just a one piece of paper that says, do you comply with HIPAA? Are you aware of the breaches? Did you take it seriously? Of course, yes, sir. David Schlachtis and the date. My concern is it's going to be a whole lot of time and effort on the part of someone within our organization, probably the chief privacy officer, to compile all that information.
Then we may need to relook very carefully at the bill, because it's certainly not intended to do that.
Okay.
It's important Chair. To avoid.
When I'm going through this, and Mr. Schlachtis, the way I'm kind of looking at it too, I don't know if it's the same way as what you're thinking, but just reading this, I know if I was in your shoes, you'd probably want to do a full audit and just go through and check to make sure nothing happened or that you might miss. And that would be my concern with this, looking at it. So if I was in your shoes and had to fill out a form that there were no files there, I'd want to go through, okay, I need every breach, everything that happened, make sure we met something. And I don't know, is that what you would probably do with your hospital, is run a full audit on everything before you filled it out and sent it back and
Chair
notified
and
that?
Representative Widener, yes. We would, you know, if I'm going to put my name to that, then absolutely I will want from my privacy officer and security officer a list of every potential breach and what happened. Luckily, in our organization, that happens very rarely. But in all honesty, when I look at the Hospital Association and the sizes of those organizations, that could be a monstrously large process for them.
Sure. So, yeah. So the question, and I'd appreciate, you know, additional conversation with HIPAA, but my understanding would be that the information that he's talking about is something that you're already required to compile as part of the HIPAA regulation. It may not be in the form that's being requested here, but from a standpoint, if you're tracking through it, from my understanding, that would be information that is already available in some form in the hospital or within the organization.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Lively, the answer is yes. We have logs I can show you right now today. The question is, it's always a question of what form it has to be in. So now I have to take all that information and put it on a whole nother form. You know what I mean?
Sure.
This doesn't require any reporting of breaches.
Okay.
It simply certifies that if you've had breaches, you've reported them to your auditor and your... I mean, this very clearly excludes you having to report breaches to a public institution. Yes.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton. I'm the Associate Vice President of Government Affairs for the Association of Oregon Hospitals and Healthcare Systems. And we have seen this bill three or four times now, and we have opposed it every time. And the reason we oppose it is because of the redundancy that it is asking for hospitals and healthcare systems to do, very much what David has responded to. But, you know, we do think it would be beneficial for this committee, before they take up this bill in all seriousness, is to hear from HIPAA experts. And I noticed a lot of people said HIPAA, but I don't know if everybody here knows what HIPAA stands for. And that is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. So in there were some protections that were federally mandated by all healthcare providers, hospitals, ASCs, long-term care, and even healthcare providers and physicians too. So we do ask that you do take this bill seriously. Hospitals and ASCs, as well as all healthcare providers, do take privacy information extremely seriously. It is right up there with quality control for us. And you know, we would like to work with the chair and the committee on making sure that they have all the information they need in regards to what currently is available and required by hospitals and others to perform these security measures under HIPAA or other state laws.
I want to make sure health insurance providers are included in that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Andy alerted me to the fact that this was the wrong bill by telling me that if this was the form of the bill, they'd back it. So, whoa, wait a minute.
My job.
Any questions?
Maybe you want this one.
Yeah. Going back to kind of what I'd asked before, so is my understanding then that if you're fully compliant with HIPAA, you're doing what's required there, this in essence is a state certification that you're doing that. So you would sign an affidavit at the end of the year saying we complied with HIPAA? Is that, and Chair Greenlick, I refer that to you too. Is that kind of how your understanding is?
Yeah, a little bit working? More than that. Because I don't think HIPAA requires breaches to be reported specifically to the board. But
okay.
I mean, significant breaches are going to be reported to the board.
Yeah, I would think so.
Otherwise, you'd be looking for a new CEO.
Maybe we could just have them send you a postcard at the end of the year on how they've done.
That'd be nice. I always like to hear. Thank you very much. We'll see you back.
Okay.
I will close public hearing. on House Bill 2076 and open up a public hearing. Is that right? Public hearing on House Bill 2081. Can you tell us what we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2081 modifies exemptions to prohibition against the practice of psychology or representation as psychologists without license and limits graduate student exemption to students seeking academic credit as part of an organized and supervised training program.
And we have Shane Hayden and Robin Henderson. Haven't seen you for a while.
I'm around.
Bill, are you testifying this one?
No. Do not anticipate, Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. No. Excuse me. I'm still trying to decide. I'm a retired psychologist, whether I need to do a conflict of interest on this bill or not. And my understanding is that I am one of a member of class, and I'm also not active, so I think...
Yeah, I think you don't have to...
I think I am excluded from it, but I just would put that on...
You know, I didn't mention in our when we adopted our new rules that the conflict of interest rules of the House that were adopted there apply to votes here. So if there is a conflict of interest here, it needs to be recorded, and then the written report needs to follow up. I'm glad you mentioned it.
Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Shane Hayden, and I am the chair of the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners. The purpose of this bill is to narrow the student exemption as it is currently written. The concern, as it is written, is that it allows a student registered in any academic program pursuing graduate training in psychology to hang out a shingle and practice. That was clearly not the intent of the student exemption. The concern is that by so doing, you have individuals out there that maybe, while well-meaning, are not prepared to offer clinical services to the public, and in the worst case scenario could injure them badly. So our intent is to revise the language so that these students may continue to provide clinical services, but as part of their academic curriculum, as part of their supervised training, and under the supervision of a licensed psychologist. In the process of so doing, we have, quote, cleaned up some language that references postdoctoral training. Well, that's logically inconsistent in the law as it now states, because postdoctoral training by definition means you're no longer a student. Therefore, we have changed that to reflect graduate students in the training of psychology. The other change is clearly a alteration of one or two sentences with the intent of hoping the bill make the bill more readable, and that is in lines 6 through 9, which are intended to be deleted and replaced with lines 10 and 11. I believe that you will find that lines 10 and 11 say the same thing as 6 through 9, but much more succinctly and clearly. Thank you.
Yeah, most councils are into that nowadays. Are there any questions? I'd like to ask a question. I don't know whether it's inadvertent or explicit. In line, Bill, I'd appreciate your comment on this. In line 21, it talks about a graduate degree in professional psychology. I was on the Board of Trustees of the Oregon School of Professional Psychology. Is this intended to only relate to a PsyD and not a PhD?
No, sir. No, it is intended to apply to any graduate training in psychology, regardless of whether it's in a traditional PhD program or in a professional school program.
Well, why have the word professional in it then?
Senator or Representative Green, look, that's probably an excellent question, other than to imply perhaps it is the profession of psychology.
Yeah, I'm a little sensitive to that with a PhD and a major in social psych, so I think I might not have qualified under this. I didn't want to practice anyway, so it wasn't a big deal. Robin?
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, thank you. I am Dr. Robin Henderson. I'm a licensed psychologist in the state of Oregon. And I must say, I didn't catch that word until you threw that in there, Chair. I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association today, who supports this bill from the Board of Psychologist Examiners. For those of us who do training and residencies with both pre- and postdoctoral students, and I guess I can't call them postdoctoral students anymore, I can tell you that this helps. It's very confusing when you work outside of an academic center, and I want to share with you a little bit about how this plays out in the real-life world of Central Oregon. We have been working for some time in the new area of embedding psychologists in primary care and having them be able to provide their services in primary care. As a brand new area of practice, I can tell you that the academic institutions, as much as we love them, have not caught up with us. So where our people learn is by the sides of those doing that type of work. I have, in the next 6 months, we'll open up two pre-doctoral internships and three post-doctoral residency slots for students to come out and learn about how to practice in primary care. And it's very important to us that it be as clear as possible so that we know that the students that we're getting are qualified to provide the care, and more important than that, that they're going to be able to be licensed in this state when they're done with us and able to practice. Because we need these types of students, and we need to allow more opportunities for internships and residencies to grow. Part of the problem in our profession, especially related to integrated primary care, is that there's not a lot of those sites available because there are a lot of hoops to go through. I will state that I'm very grateful to George Fox University for partnering with us. We don't have the rigor to understand exactly how you jump through all those hoops, but they've partnered with us and taken those barriers away. Bills like this help us get closer so that we can improve our workforce, especially in new areas that aren't covered in the academic setting.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Would you have a problem if I had an amendment drafted to delete the professional before psychology on that line?
Chairman, I do not believe so.
No, we wouldn't either.
I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Good.
Nothing is lost.
Would you ask for that amendment to be drafted? Thank you. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for proposing. We want to make your life as easy as we possibly can.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2081 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2638. You starting?
Sure.
We have the 2638. Bring both of the lists. We'll find out who else we have in a minute, Representative Conger. Unless you have somebody you want to fly wing with you.
I think
Robin's
going to testify.
Again?
Oh,
others,
I don't know. We can all come up together.
Two trips for the price of one.
Right. I'll come join you.
Okay.
Make use of your trip to Salem.
That's right. You have a slide.
Thanks.
I didn't know I could have a slide. I could have brought you a slide.
Well, now you tell me. How do I get this to full screen?
Hit F5.
Yeah, call IT.
Escape.
We gotta get F5. We gotta get IS in here.
Oh, F5.
All of them. The whole.
No, not
F5. I
don't.
No.
Or hit F5 like somebody was telling you.
You're right.
You probably designed the whole program, didn't you?
That's why
you probably could have PowerPoint, didn't you?
Chair Greenlick, colleagues. For the record, Jason Conger, representing District 54, which is Bend. I'm joined here today by my good friend and fellow healthcare warrior today, Dr. Robin Henderson, who actually helped me.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Was that warrior or warrior?
I think.
For each.
If we're already going to get into the spelling on this, this is going to be a long testimony. I think you know the answer already. She's a warrior and I'm a warrior. But in conversations with Dr. Henderson and others in healthcare professions related to CCOs, related to our healthcare reform effort, I began to realize as we were working on our SB 1580 in 2012, I began to realize that the focus of the reform was entirely on two parts of the healthcare delivery system, the provider side and the payer side. And in many respects, the goal with the CCO structure in my mind was to combine them, not completely, but to put payers and providers together to some extent in order to break down quote-unquote silos in healthcare and begin to transform healthcare with the overriding goal of achieving the triple aim. And no, I think everybody is familiar with the triple aim. If you haven't heard of it, raise your hand.
Sometimes referred to as a triple A mumbo jumbo. Right?
I think that's probably a good description, but a noble goal, and I think we did a really good job. But part of the picture, and I guess you could call it the third leg of the healthcare reform stool, was to deal with the patient side, the patient behavior side. So I'll give you a quick summary of the bill, and then talk about a couple other things, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Henderson. HB 2638 would instruct the Oregon Health Authority to establish a new grant program. In the draft you have before you, there's a $20 million figure attached to it, money which would be taken from the tobacco settlement. I'll come back to that in a second. The grant program would be intended to encourage Oregon's coordinated care organizations to develop pilot projects designed to improve patient engagement in and patient accountability for their own health and wellness. To receive a grant, CCOs would apply to OHA is the idea, and the grant is, I think, pretty intuitive, but I wanted to include in there the idea that part of the grant would have to relate to engaging patients in their health and improving healthcare outcomes. So consistent with transformation, but with an element of how do you involve the patient in those health outcomes. And then, of course, we want measurement. We want reports back on specific performance metrics. And by that, I don't mean to overlap with the CCOs, but performance metrics specific for the pilot program. Also, I should say, because I think Oregon knows from experience, and I have certainly heard, that some kinds of incentives and penalties may be limited, that could relate to these kinds of grant programs, may be limited by federal law. The bill specifically contemplates that OHA would take the grant projects and go to CMS and apply for a waiver to be able to do them and comply with federal law. We talk about the problem a little bit more. So I have a slide that is intended to illustrate the difference between our current reform and where I think we should ultimately be going. Again, distinguishing between the reform, which focused on supply side factors, factors that are outside the individual, that relate to healthcare and health of the individual. And then there's demand-side factors which appear inside the individual. And, of course, the title of the slide is Determinants of Healthcare Use, whether you get sick or not, whether you actually, when you get sick, actually go and access the healthcare system. All of those things are relevant. Obviously, it's broad in concept. But if you think about our reforms, they're all on the supply side. And is that a complete approach to healthcare reform?
She's bringing up the other one.
Oh, well, I had two slides on
here. She's getting you there.
Not in the PowerPoint together, they're separate.
This isn't my laptop, that's why. So I have another slide that when we get it up here, you'll see it projects what part of the healthcare costs, what part of, broadly speaking, in the aggregate, what part of healthcare costs are accounted for by medical care? And you may have seen this chart before. I remember the first time I saw it. It does make sense, but it's a little surprising because we're all very highly focused on the medical care side of healthcare reform. And 40% of the cost of healthcare is from contributing factors that are in lifestyle and behavior, which are those demand side factors that were in the prior slide. So there is a lot of complexity in trying to deal with this. And I want to give a couple of quick examples of what this might mean in practice. You know, in achieving the AAA, we want better health and we want to bend the cost curve down. If you're a doctor, and we want to hold the system accountable, we have to have good accountability built into the system because of the moral hazard involved in capitated payments and the possibility of just reducing access or reducing the implementation of care on the part of the healthcare provider to save money. Not to save money, to save time and money, I guess. And so we need accountability, we need performance metrics. But imagine if you're a healthcare provider and we tell you, as we should, we're going to be watching to see if your patients get healthier. But you prescribe a series of drugs to lower blood pressure for a patient, and the patient just doesn't ever fill the prescription. Or they fill a prescription and they take half and then they're done. How does it help for us to hold that provider accountable when the determinant of healthcare is completely outside the provider's control? The answer is, of course, it doesn't. And it is, in fact, a discouraging factor for someone to be held accountable for something that they can't control, and it defeats the whole purpose. So part of this, so that was one example. Let me give you another example of how this is already happening. Federally qualified health clinics, FQHCs, are a major part of the Medicaid delivery system at the provider level. And they are somewhat unique. They're not typical providers. They have a requirement now to always make their patients pay for some portion of their care. They do it on a sliding scale so that people who can't afford to pay don't pay more than they can afford, but everyone pays something. And I think the intent behind that is similar to this, but that is only in the case of FQHCs. It doesn't apply to the rest of our Medicaid delivery system. So, to wrap it up in the interest of time, I don't think that I am qualified, and with all due respect, I don't think any of you are qualified to say what incentives and what penalties would actually work to engage patients more in their health. One would think intuitively that your health is enough of an incentive. But we know that's not true because, with the exception of all of us, everybody else in the world engages in unhealthy behavior. So I think we have to do more, or we should do more, if we're being sincere about achieving the triple aim. And we all know how important that is. We all know how important it is to bend the cost curve, but without sacrificing outcomes, without sacrificing health of communities and individuals. And missing this third leg is leaving the picture of healthcare reform incomplete. And I don't believe that ultimately, if we're focused on 10% of the factors that influence health outcomes instead of the rest, to the exclusion of the rest, that we're going to be successful. So instead of us trying to figure out, and I should say me, I should attribute this to you, but I just don't know how to do it. But part of the beauty of the system that we've created here in the state of Oregon is that CCOs are intended to be pods of innovation. They're intended to be designed in a way that they can better understand what works in their community And so this bill would empower them and give them an incentive, plus the resources on a pilot project basis, to start to learn and demonstrate for the rest of us what actually could work. Final thing I'll mention is I've been told there's a lot of concern about the source of funds coming back to the tobacco settlement money. When the bill was drafted, it was before the governor's proposed budget was released. And I, like everyone else, had my eye on that big $120 million pot of money. However, I'm very aware that it would not serve the purpose, ultimately, to break down our Medicaid funding. And so I intend to offer an amendment to this bill. If I can identify another source of funds, I will. If I can't, I will identify a characteristic of funds from which OHA can pull the money and put into this program without detracting from the rest of the system. And the second amendment that I intend, hope to offer to this bill would be to authorize a work group. And I'm not a fan of work groups, but I've seen them work, no pun intended, recently. And I think that might be a good way in parallel to leverage the work of these demonstration projects through a group of people to work on figuring out ultimately how this third leg of healthcare reform can be integrated with the rest of our healthcare reform. So thank you.
Representative Conger, I heard yesterday that the Oregon Health Authority, I think through the Health Policy Board, has put together a group to study exactly this problem. Are you familiar with that? Could you check it out and see if that serves the purpose you need?
It's
a very serious effort to do exactly what you're proposing here.
Yes, for the record, I'm Dr. Robin Henderson, and I am the Director of Government Affairs at St. Charles Health System right now.
Oh, a different hat, huh?
Let's change hats. I would have changed sweaters, but I didn't bring an extra today, and that way you could identify me differently. Representative Conger and I have been talking about this idea for some time, and what I wanted to do was to have an opportunity to paint just a brief picture, what I kind of refer to as a tease, about what we could do with this if we authorize this, because I think there is going to need to be a little bit of waiver action in order to make this work. Back in the day, and the good Dr. Representative Kettimer will remember, back in the day when the Oregon Health Plan first started, I was but a mere child doing my internship as an undergraduate student at Western Psychological and Counseling Services in the early days of the Oregon Health Plan. And in the mental health side of things, there's a long-held belief that we all learn about, and it's true, it's been proven out in studies, that consumers who contribute to, in some meaningful fashion, to their therapy get better benefits from that. And in those early project days, we have mechanisms to do that we later found were not okay. So we don't do that anymore. But what I want to talk with you about today is a big bushel of carrots. People hear patient accountability and they think two things. They think carrot and they think stick. And I want to talk about carrots. As a health system at St. Charles, we know that one of the biggest drivers of health care costs are our own employees and their dependents' health care. We know that. And as health care workers, we're really lousy at taking care of ourselves. We have bad outcomes, diabetes, we smoke. I don't smoke, but, you know, the whole nine yards. We're not good at this. So we started to look at how could we impact the healthcare system by lowering our own healthcare costs? And the best way to do that is to start to create ways of patient accountability. So as we're implementing this program at St. Charles, and I'll give you a couple nuggets from that, what I want you to remember is we're also now thinking about, with this project that Representative Conger is putting forward, how could we do a demonstration and apply to our own CCO to say, hey, request these funds and let's look at this with a portion of our population simultaneously. So we've developed a program that's looking at our own wellness projects, right? We do a health risk screening assessment with everybody. We check their diabetes. We check their blood work, all those other types of things. But the kicker is you earn points along the way. And those points, for me as an employee, will result in a bonus check at the end of the year. But when we've been talking about this with the Medicaid population, we know that a waiver is not probably going to give us the ability to do a bonus check. But it would give us the ability to do things like farmers market dollars, free yoga classes, pedometers, you know, participation in different types of activities that normally would cost funds. And I want to tell you a little bit about what we've learned in just the initial health risk screening assessment. We've seen now about 117 people in our health system who've gone through this screening assessment and program. And in those first 3 weeks, we had 8 people who were identified with excessively high blood pressure in the room and were referred immediately to a nurse. We had 10 out of the 36 people that we screened in one portion of this project who, much as they said, "I don't smoke," smoked. We had one person who was immediately identified as hypoglycemic and needed an immediate nurse intervention at that point. We know that about 70% of the people that we've seen so far have moderately elevated blood pressure and have been referred for additional therapy and services. And my point in all of this is we need to find a way to incentivize people to go get the basics done. And I think we can take what our hospital is learning in this project and apply it to a demonstration Medicaid project if we have the ability to apply for funds for that through our CCO. Thank you for your time.
There's a whole field of contingency research in behavioral treatment that points us out that even symbolic rewards,
yes,
can work very effectively.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any questions? We have 2 more witnesses. Oops, sorry. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I like this because this addresses my number one concern about this whole healthcare transformation issue that we have skirted in all the Wednesday night meetings and all the other things. We're right now investing somewhere north of $2 billion worth of other people's money in this change.
Yes.
We have not yet engaged the patient for buy-in. I used to do asthma programs, and I know for a fact we can reduce asthma hospitalizations with group therapy down to very near zero. And it's just a matter of incentivizing patients with a 2x4 or otherwise to actually take part in the success of their own care. Once they start to do that, you can't get them out of the program. But it's that first over the transom of getting them to actually sit down and do something about their care other than expecting the doctor to fix them. And I'm probably one of the worst of those people.
Can I call Courtney Dresser?
I think it's a great program.
Sure, while you're talking.
And I was going to say really quickly, Chair Greenlich, to your point, Representative, I've been at the Community Advisory Council meetings, and this is the number one topic that keeps coming up meeting after meeting. Our own Consumer Advisory Council is begging for us to find a way to incentivize the patient.
But
thank you.
$20 million up against a $2 billion investment on the table isn't much.
Yep. I know. I'm fascinated by the concept of incentivizing patients with 2x4s.
Yeah. I don't think that's a carrot she had.
Although, given the price of 2x4s, it might be a really nice carrot.
Nobody ever said I was a nice person, so.
I did.
Oh, okay.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Briefly, huh?
Yes, of course. Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. Patient engagement and patient responsibility has been a topic we have been talking about to this committee and others throughout the implementation of CCOs and the development of CCOs. So we are thankful for Representative Conger for bringing this forward. This is a concept and a discussion that we need to continue to have. There are some models out there. We should find those models and see what works best in the CCO community. So we encourage the discussion.
Good.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Dana Sterringer. I'm a government programs director at Family Care. We're a CCO in the Tri-County area. And we, too, are interested in this discussion, obviously, in all of our CCO development over the past 6 or 7 months. We've had a lot of very interesting ideas come forth from providers in the community and other county and social service agencies about how we can better address healthcare needs, and having some ability to get a pilot project off the ground to try something new, try something different and innovative is a very interesting concept. So we are also here in support of House Bill 2638.
There's a whole pot of money, I think $37 million for transformational activities in the CCO movement that each of the CCOs can apply to. Wouldn't that not be possible to do these kind of pilots as a part of your transformational work, using some of that resources?
Chair Greenlee, we are certainly doing some innovative pilot projects now with the global budget funding that we have for the CCO. I think this is an opportunity to maybe on a smaller scale or on a less risk scale be able to try something different.
But I don't understand, when there is $37 million waiting to do that, you would need a pilot project with an unrecognized source of funds. I mean, is this, many people won't believe me, but my perspective is that we don't need an extra statute if we don't need an extra statute. Why? What's stopping you from doing this now with potential funds that are available to do it? And I don't mean your base funding. I mean this.
Chair Green, like, nothing is stopping us. We are moving forward with several innovative projects. For instance, we just recently announced that we are increasing primary care provider payments. as an innovative approach.
Boy, there's an innovation. To give doctors more money. I never heard of that one.
It's interestingly not been applied very well over the past few years. So this
really
is a new way to approach supporting primary care as a way to control costs.
I would argue that giving doctors more money has been tried and has had an effect, but not the effects we wanted it to have. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions, this panel?
Well, I'd just like to respond to your question about the funding, because I think it's actually very much on point. If the money is ultimately available for transformation, why wouldn't CCOs pick up this issue on their own? And eventually, I think they might. But I think the barrier is there are things that they can do on the provider side where we're already focused, and I think that's where most of their attention is focused in transformation now, because it's controllable. But if you were to propose a creative way to engage patients, there's an involving an accountability aspect to it, there's at least a decent chance that you would need a CMS waiver. And without the statutory direction, I'm not sure that OHA is going to dedicate the effort to get that. And if we don't have that system in place, then I think what will happen is we will remain focused on the 10% that we are now of the healthcare.
You might need a CMS waiver if you're going to try and take money away from Medicaid patients, but I don't think you would need a CMS waiver to do things like contingent reward systems that Robin was talking about. I mean, to give them a Fred Meyer coupon if they really come and do some stuff or something.
I think you may be right, I think it's probably a little bit, it's complicated.
Yes.
And the incentives for the CCOs to actually do something on this aren't there, so they'll go where they, I would, if I were in their shoes, I'd go where I could actually do something without the help of OHA.
There is that $37 million pot, though, to fund things exactly like that.
Proposed. I don't know if it will end up surviving through the budget process, but I agree. But this could be part of that $37
million. Okay. Great.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Bye. May interject here a little bit, just real quick, something that you may want to look into with CCO, because I've actually been kind of working the same thing that Representative Conger has been doing, but it appears that under the federal law, if they're going to an emergency room and it's a non-emergency, that you can basically have your hospitals just stabilize them or charge them a copay or something at that point if they're using the system incorrectly. Your increase in payments to doctors, which is a good thing, so doctors will take them, but if you can get an agreement worked out there, I think you can do that legally with the conversations I've had with LC here. I'm trying to make it a little more clear for you to make it easier, and hopefully we'll have a vehicle for doing that here.
I don't think
quite
you
soon.
Can, under the current regulation we have, charge Medicaid recipients a copay.
Well, if
we've tried that, and all it did was end up with more hospitals.
If they go to the emergency room for a non-emergency, then you can, is the way I was understanding Lori, which she's probably hearing this right now, and I'll run down here
we'll
and square it away.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing. We'll wait to hear further the extent to which the Health Policy Board is moving in this direction. We'll see how it fits. We'll hear back from you, Representative Conrad.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out.
And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2133, and I'll go out there again with Senator Shields, who's here to also testify in this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This morning, Senator Shields and I testified in the Senate Judiciary Committee on a CCO bill, and I made the point that this was an extraordinarily important day in the history of medical care in Oregon, with the hearing of a bill this morning on whether CCO meetings should be defined as open meetings, public meetings, or not, and this bill today talking about the role of the Citizen Advisory Council, the Community Advisory Council, in the real work of the CCOs. We created CCOs in a set of bills over the last two sessions, and we did a rather extraordinary thing. We used the shield that a state can use against antitrust action, and we created essentially monopolies to spend an enormous amount of public dollars under the shield of antitrust, against antitrust action. And the question that we've left unresolved, and which will be resolved in this session as we move forward, looking at both the CCO, the transformation movement, and the exchanges, is what's the nature of these organizations? Will they turn out as we intended, or some of us intended in the early development of the bill, to be true community organizations, to have monopolies, to spend federal money and state money, and a lot of it, on behalf of the citizens of the state? If we really believe that what we've done is create a bunch of insurance companies and given them a monopoly because that's the way, well, because we like insurance companies and we wanted a bunch of new ones, then we have one model for how they ought to behave and how we regulate them. If, on the other hand, we believe that we've created a new public community organization worthy of having monopoly rights to have access to money and to provide public service, then I think we have another model. This bill, well, maybe not at the heart of the world. And in fact, I think the bill we heard this morning, we testified on this morning, was perhaps a more critical bill. But this bill is a very important one, and it simply says, when it comes time to recertify CCOs, a part of that recertification process is that the CCO must bring to their community advisory committee their business plan and get approval of that business plan against a set of specific criteria that are listed in the bill. If the CAC can't come to agreement, won't certify the business plan, the bill talks about how the Oregon Health Authority can step in and has processes for dealing with this. It seems to me, and this was submitted as a committee bill, it seems to me this is a vital move for making sure these organizations really are responsive to the needs of their community as expressed through their community advisory committee. With that, I'll pass the ball.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lateral.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22, and I'm also a member of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. As Representative Greenlich mentioned, earlier this morning, we both testified in support of Senate Bill 412, which basically said that CCOs should meet in public and that the doors of the meeting should be open instead of the organization's meeting behind closed doors, the board of directors meeting behind closed doors. I'm here to also support this bill in front of your committee, House Bill 2133, for basically the same premise. I think there's nothing wrong with taking a look at the very good work that we did at House Bill 3650 and 1580 and saying, okay, how can we improve it now that we're into the next session? You'll hear a lot of arguments about why you shouldn't, that you know, the ink's barely dry on those bills and we need to give them time, from some friends of mine. And I think those are reasonable arguments to have. But I think the question before you is, how do we improve going forward? And Representative Greenlich underlined a couple of distinguishing characteristics that I think the public should be aware of that we gave to coordinated care organizations. One, they're dealing with public money. Public money. They're fundamentally different from a hospital, from most nonprofit organizations that get a mix of contributions from individuals and grants from private foundations, that when they have some private resources. This is virtually all public money. Two, we wrote into the CCO language an antitrust exemption, and we've shielded them from that. And in many areas, CCOs are virtual monopolies. And what that means to your constituents is that if the CCO, meeting behind closed doors, makes a decision that their provider is not going to be in the network, that patient really has nowhere else to go. Very vulnerable population, nowhere else to go. And that's why I think it's so important that these issues be done in the light of day and that the Community Advisory Board have a really meaty role in this process. So, because what we're talking about is not only coordinating care, we're talking about allocation of resources, and that is the big job of the Board of Directors. How much money goes into primary care, how much money goes into the emergency room, et cetera. And I am quite pleased that family care in the metropolitan Portland area has made some significant investments in primary care, and I do want to commend them for that. But I just think that we need to take some next steps. It's not a bad idea for this next legislative session to stay ahead of the curve. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay. Any questions for the panel? Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, either one of you can tackle this, but I understand what you're trying to do here and get at, and there's, believe it or not, some of it I agree with, some of it I don't, because they are still getting together on everything. But I'm just wondering, because CCOs do come competitive with each other, and if we start opening up their business plans for everybody, like when I do a business plan, it's confidential. When I show it to investors, it's confidential, and they're not supposed to show it to anybody else. So are we going to have confidentiality on this? And I think it's something we need to look at when we're doing here. And I think a piece of the pie that we're missing a little bit is we also have OHA sitting over here with over 2,000 employees. What are we doing to shrink the amount of money that's going to OHA and start moving to the CCOs? Because what we've created right now is another set of hands in the pie. So we're getting a lot of money eaten up in administrative costs and not getting out to the patients. So I think this is something at a state, if we're going to go after CCOs here, we probably should be doing it with OHA as well. They say they need more employees and they're understaffed, but 2,000 is quite a few employees when they're not having to administer the program and the CCOs are administering it. So I'm wondering,
that's not really in the scope of this bill.
Well, I'm just thinking if we could tie this something together with the bill, we need to give them some confidentiality here and start guaranteeing certainty and moving some of this out of the state's hands. And maybe we'd want to do it separately. I wouldn't mind putting it together, though.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, when we deal with Senate Bill 412, if it passes the Senate and comes to us, we'll be talking about the confidentiality issue. But this particular bill doesn't say that the community advisory commission, in dealing with the business plan, is doing it in public. I'd be happy to argue that they should be doing it in public. And we don't have a lot of competition among the CCOs. There is some in the metropolitan area and a little bit in other places in the state. But the fact is, this doesn't refer to doing it in public, although I would argue it should be done in public.
Okay. I think Representative Conger was next, and then Thompson and whatever.
First of all, thank you for your attention to this issue, and I certainly think that transparency is important, and I think I actually understand, or at least I think I have a picture of a piece of this that I would say is a concern to me too, but I wanted to weigh in and ask a question. Weigh in first on the idea that CCOs are all funded by public money. I can't speak for other CCOs, but I know a couple, at least, the ones that I'm familiar with, are not funded entirely by public money. And the one that I'm most familiar with, of course, is in Central Oregon. And the providers have pitched in over time, actually, pre-CCO formation, post-CCO formation, and have expended significant resources of their own in developing transformation concepts, and have committed to continue to expend more of their money. I also...
All of their revenue, however, is public funds.
No, that's not true.
Really?
Yeah, hospitals don't collect money from private insurance.
We're not talking about hospitals here.
Talking about hospitals. I'm talking about the CCO being funded with the hospital's money.
But the CCO, all of the revenue, the point that was being made is all of the revenue of the CCO is public money.
And I understood the point. It's not correct. Where did the global budget from OHA is certainly public money because it's coming from the state. I understand that, and I'm not arguing that point. My point is that money that is being utilized by the CCO, in my personal experience, I know this to be true. I've observed it, and I assume that other CCOs, maybe not universally, but probably have similar things that are going on, where the providers of healthcare who are involved in various aspects of the CCO are actually contributing money and resources towards the operation of the CCO.
Yes. The only question is, the only assertion that's being made here is that the revenue stream of the CCOs is entirely public funds.
And
whether
that's not true.
There's a doctor that sits on the board and that doctor is contributing his time and money to the operation of the board, whether the hospital and putting up revenue to back the risk pool is public money, but the issue is the whole revenue pool, year after year, mm-hmm. is public money, and that's the only issue that we're raising. I think these are great organizations. I don't have a problem with these organizations. I'm proud of developing.
I don't think you do, actually. And if I could continue my point.
Please.
I disagree. I mean, maybe it's a definitional issue about what is revenue. But if money is being given to a CCO, you know, many of them are formed as 501c3s, which presumably means that they want to accept charitable donations. If money is being given other than in the global budget, and it's not from a government entity, then it's not public money. And, you know, you can argue whether that's revenue or not revenue. I guess to me it doesn't matter. The point is that all of the money that they expend through the CCO does not come from the state. And so, this is not a revenue issue, but I also want to point out that I don't know where the reserves for these CCOs came from, mm-hmm. but the reserves are at risk, and I'm assuming that the state, under no circumstance, funded those reserves.
That's correct.
So, this is not a publicly funded entity in its entirety. And I just wanted to make the point that I think there's, and again, I can't speak for all the CCOs. The ones that I'm familiar with are not funded entirely by public money. The other, and this is more of a question, I guess. You've both said that these entities are exempt from antitrust law, and I know that in SB 1580, or maybe it was House Bill 3650, I think it was SB 1580, we put an explicit exemption from state antitrust law. And I'm not sure how valuable that is, because I don't know if the state ever prosecutes a state-based antitrust case, but we can't exempt them from federal antitrust law, I don't believe.
Well, actually, federal antitrust law provides safe harbor provisions for protection from the federal antitrust law, and it requires a set of state activities to manage the process such that it provides a safe harbor. I'm not an attorney, nor do I play one on television, but that's my reading of the development of the bill. The question is, what are those criteria? Let's see. You played a lawyer on television.
No, I mean, Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Conger, I understand your point. I understand your point about the private versus public. I think, you know, we can parse that. But I do think, and I hope you'll agree, that the overwhelming majority of the funds that these groups are dealing with are public dollars. That's my main point.
So let's get a few more questions, because I see Representative Freeman here to testify. So, Representative Thompson?
One of my concerns about this bill is the specificity it puts into the system at this time. We're very much engaged in an evolutionary process on establishing CCOs, their relationship with their advisory councils, and that's all different. All the CCOs are different. As far as I can tell, the relationships and the sophistication of their relationship with their advisory council is all different. I would think that we need to better define that role. I like the idea of the business plan for the CCOs being answerable to OHA. I think that's a solid foundation. I'm not sure I'm comfortable, and partly with what little I know about these advisory councils around the state, having them in that particular position unless we better define what their job is. And actually, be very honest with you, approving the business plan for the CCO was not something in my thought process that is a primary function of those advisory councils. Certainly, maybe informing the advisory councils of the business plan or opening it for comment, but this seems to me to formalize a cross-control function that I'm not sure the advisory councils are prepared to do at this point. And we may be distorting the reporting relationship. This is a lot of money we're talking about involved here. And I'm not comfortable with throwing this provision on advisory councils when we really don't know what advisory councils are supposed to do. And it's been my opinion that most of the CCOs don't have a very good formalized relationship with their advisory councils yet. We told them they have to have one. We didn't tell them why.
Huh. And, that said, Representative.
That is a warning that my time is up.
He's done talking. You turn the lights back on. Yeah. Madam.
Somebody took my wallet.
So,
Madam Chair, Mr. Thompson, I would like to answer that.
Representative.
I believe the advisory councils are not being taken seriously. And the most common practice is you have an advisory council, you elect a chair, there might be five people on it, and the chair sits on the governing board frequently as a model. But we're talking about recertification of the CCOs, which is downstream.
Yeah.
This seemed to me a good way to build some expectation about what the advisory council ought to be prepared to do. And if you know 3 years from now or 4 years from now, your advisory council is going to have to understand what it is you're doing sufficiently enough to approve or disapprove your business plan, then you have work to do with that council. You have to end up making sure the council's properly formed. I don't think you need to put all CPAs on it, but I think you need to make sure there are community members who are prepared to deal with this, and you need to be prepared to deal with the advisory council in a serious way. So this is an attempt to deal with a downstream issue in advance, because I think, and it's hard to figure out what other ways you could put in place to say, hey, take them seriously. I mean, this means you got to take those guys seriously, because 3 years from now or 4 years from now, they're going to be affecting whether you get recertified or not.
Ken. Okay, so I've got Representative Kenemer, Representative Clem,
we'll be back,
Thompson and Widener.
Sure. I can be excused.
Okay, thank you, Senator Shields.
No, I wanted Senator Shields.
Oh.
Take one more.
Okay. Well, two. Is that all right?
With? Yeah, not
fine. Okay. Go ahead,
actually, real quick, because Chip, your input on this is important to me as well, but one of the things I see, because we've kind of hit on the business plan here a little bit, and there's lots of people who develop business plans. Developing a business plan and writing a business plan and executing a business plan are two different things.
Three different things.
Yeah, well, three different things. So,
probably more.
But when we put this together, I mean, would kind of like you to think, are we setting up a deal where there could be these CCOs getting together and they're submitting a plan, but they're executing something different than what the plan is, and there's no way really to monitor that or judge it. They're just telling the advisory council what they want to hear, and they may know in the back of their minds that doesn't work, so we're going to do this over here, but they're not going to let us get away with it. So I wonder if that went through your thought process on any of this.
Oh, he was asking. Oh, I mean, okay. My answer, that's a scary proposition, and you're absolutely right.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Thompson, I think that's why I think we need as much transparency on this as possible, because I think that all of us agree the worst case scenario for any of this is that we end up creating an unregulated monopoly. And I have no gripes with the CCOs in my area, but just the facts are, in one of the CCOs, you have virtually every hospital system, and they're meeting behind closed doors, making decisions that, could adversely impact competition on through the other CCO. But also, I think they're not really recognizing this, but this kind of transparency of bringing the community boards in is actually in their best interest, because otherwise people will, I think, begin to suspect the worst unless they feel like they have some transparency to this process.
Let me follow up on that real quick.
A quick one, because half the people here want to ask questions.
What you're saying, there's some collusion going on. A business plan wouldn't stop that from happening, because if I own a CCO, my goal is to go out, I want the contracts with all these hospitals so this guy can't have them, then I can handle more patients and receive more state dollars. So that competition's going to be there, and you won't stop it with a business plan. So I'm wondering if there needs to be a little more thought process and how we go about this.
OHA needs to oversee the business plans. That is their responsibility, to say, if this is a business plan, to what extent are you operating on the basis of that plan? But it's a tough problem.
Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'm not suggesting that there's collusion going on, but what I'm saying is that the more transparency we have on that process and how you're allocating those resources and making sure there's a second set of eyes on it and approving it can only be helpful.
Okay. So if you need to leave, thank you. Yes. Senator Shields. Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think maybe mine's more a comment than a question. I think there is concern that advisory committees are not being taken or may not be taken seriously, and how do you enforce that? I just think that, for example, a business plan is not the best way to achieve that, because first of all, a business plan that's going to be submitted publicly as a public document is going to be highly redacted, and I suspect not a clear reflection of some of the thinking going on internally for lots of reasons. Competitive, patient privacy, because it's built usually on instances that occur, and I just have some fundamental concerns about this.
Okay, Representative Clem?
I think I'm going to wait.
Unless you wanted to respond.
Yeah. It's okay, I'm going to wait. There are just more people here to speak, so I'm going to wait.
Yeah, okay. Representative Thompson.
I'll hold off. I suspect we're not going to work this bill today.
We are not.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Freeman, thank you for your patience.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman. I represent House District 2. And in a previous session, I co-chaired the Special Joint Committee for Healthcare Transformation and the Subcommittee for Health and Human Services, where a lot of the transformation work was done. I'm impressed that you got through this topic so quickly. We spent hours and hours and hours on it. So I'm here today not about the Senate bill, but specifically about the bill that you guys are addressing. I have many concerns about the Senate bill, but I thought I would share a little bit of the history and a little bit of the work that we did and what was one of the most openly public processes I've ever been involved in. So as we started talking about the balance between the governing board and the Citizen Advisory Council, there was the same tensions you're hearing today brought up, and we heard from hundreds of individuals and groups on how we would find that perfect balance. And one thing I will tell you is that in each community, each group of people, each organization, it's going to be slightly different, and that's the intent. The whole idea is to make sure, and I was a huge advocate for having people that receive these services on the Community Advisory Council and have them have an active role in how services are delivered. And we did that by having a person from their committee on the full board. That is a requirement of a board of a governing board of a CCO, is that the Citizen Advisory Council have a member on the full board. Mm-hmm. So to think that they don't have an active part of what's going on or not informed on what's happening is a little bit untrue, because in fact they have a member of theirs on the full board. Now there is many great roles for a Citizen Advisory Council to perform, including what some might think is the most important role, and that only a Citizen Advisory Council can perform, and that is patient responsibility. We as a legislature decided very early on that we are not going to be able to tell people how to do things correctly as it pertains to their health. And that really, if we're going to get any savings or any better health outcomes from CCOs, we're going to have to get people to engage and be responsible for their own health. And that truly is the grand role and the most important role of this entire endeavor, and that is wholly placed upon the Citizen Advisory Commission. I would hope that these Citizen Advisory Councils or commissions would certainly take that role on and provide to the full board alternatives and suggestions that best match their community and their needs. So to think that this group has no function, I can't disagree with you more. The reason we decided not to have business plans and operating functions and huge authority given to this group is because largely this group receives the services. So as you might imagine, they're not at risk on the financial end of it. They're not accountable to OHA for the money that's being spent or the outcomes. They simply receive services. So having those people that receive the services decide what services are going to be there and how they're going to be delivered solely is not a great idea. Or have them approve a business plan that makes those choices is probably not the right role for them either. So hear me say this clearly. I agree that the Citizen Advisory Council is important. I believe they have a very vital function in the whole system of transformation and the whole idea of coordinating care. But I think their focus needs to be on patient responsibility and making sure that the folks that are on the full board understand how that works, along with, there's other statutory requirements, including the health assessment and some other things. So they have an active role. And finally, I would say on this bill and all other bills that have to do with the coordinated care organization structure, I would be very careful this early in the evolution of coordinated care organizations to move the dial again. The amount of change that we're asking from our community and providers and people receiving this care is enormous. I can't state that enough. We are asking people to do things so much different than they did just months ago to now come in and start changing with a series of bills how it is they're supposed to be doing things, I think would be a mistake. And I'm the first to admit that likely what we did wasn't perfect, but I would suggest that we wait a few years, let things cycle through, let people get up and running, and then take a look and see what would be most appropriate to fix problems and how it would address concerns that are coming up. But give it some time, please. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Clem?
So, thank you for coming down, Representative. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about what the potential vision is for CCOs later. I think we are having a conversation right now about essentially, you know, Oregon health plan recipients, but you know, I'm new to this committee. I voted for the bill, but I didn't pay attention to every last, you know, period in the whole thing. I will certainly admit that. So when I saw the bill, I know my CCO is an LLC. I own three myself. So the thought of me submitting my business plan to anybody was I thought it was a little absurd. But you know, I realize there's some monopoly powers or some other things where it's not quite like my computer business or my orchard where I don't have all those benefits. So I guess the question is, where might CCOs go? Might they go on the exchange and just start taking at some point completely private insurance plans and private dollars, individuals paying cash? Might they enroll? Where do we think this might go beyond just right now, this one pool of people?
Great. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Chair Greenlick, and Vice Chair Thompson. Sorry, you were Vice Chair, not Co-Chair. I've got to get off the Co-Chair talk. And Representative Clem. First, just because you're new on this committee doesn't mean it's unique that you didn't see a lot of the bill.
Yeah.
The bills didn't get worked through this committee, although this committee got a lot of updates on the bill. So the bill's path actually was through Healthcare Transformation Joint Committee, to Ways and Means Subcommittee, to the floor. And then the second session, it went through Senate Healthcare, to Ways and Means Subcommittee, and then to the floor. So all of us have a little catching up to do. Some of these members were on the joint committee, so some of them have seen the bill very closely, but that's not unique to you. So specifically, where do I see CCOs going? First and foremost, the intent of the bill was for the Medicaid population. And quite clearly, the Medicaid population, by anybody's measure, is one of the most difficult populations to care for. The utilization rate, the people that decide not to take their medicine, all the factors that cause an increased cost are contained largely in this group of people. So if this delivery system proves to be efficient and effective, I think it would be very easy to argue that other systems would be served well by it. I think there is a reasonable reason to wait and make sure that it works. Again, I mean, this is uncharted water. I mean, many of us sat through those committee hearings, and many people know how big of a change this is in the delivery system. So I think first it's important to make sure it's delivering the results that we expect and hope for before we start talking about bringing additional populations in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my belief, if it will work for the Medicaid population and provide a much better delivery system where primary care and preventative care and all those things that we've talked about become the normal and the standard, I think it would be very easy to talk to folks from PEB and OEB,
mm-hmm.
and possibly have an exchange product. But first, you have to prove the system. I mean, this is brand new. So some of these folks are literally just starting to learn each other's names that are sitting around a table and are expected to start providing care in a coordinated way. I would tell you, oftentimes when they've come together, really it's a name only, and it's going to take some time to build the trust and the working relationship and really get down to the level of care and coordinating. That's going to take some time. So my answer is, I think there is an unlimited possibility. However, I'm cautious to say, first, you got to make sure it works with the Medicaid population in which the bill calls for it to work with.
Just one follow-up?
Sure.
And then you've already spoken to this mostly, but I just want to touch on it again. You know, the term advisory council to me doesn't mean you approve anything. It means you get advised of. But you also are thinking advising on certain issues that might be very proprietary is even not necessarily what they were originally intended to be. They were, you know, might have more authority in certain areas and none in other areas, but all I know is the name. I don't even know who's on the one local one, for example.
So vice chair, chair, vice chair. you're exactly right, Representative Clem, that the advisory council was meant to engage citizens. If you remember, on the full board, we have a requirement for members at large, which is also meant to be community members. Because you have all these different major components of healthcare delivery on the full board, and you have members at large, the level of transparency for these dollars is greater than it's ever been, and it's been pretty good. Managed care organizations, hospitals, mental care organizations, dental care organizations have all had to report and work with Oregon Health Authority and DHS before that on transparency and reports. So it's not like this all goes into some sort of a secret work and nobody knows what happens. Yeah. So all along, the advisory council was meant to be just that and to help bring those people that are going to get these services. And there was story after story of great advice or great suggestions given by people that receive care on how to better deliver that care. And I can share examples. I remember several great examples. But that is really what was the idea, along with, I mean, their statutory function of working on the health assessment for the community is a huge task. I mean, it's not like we just put it there and kind of shunned it to the side. It is actually intended to serve very importantly in the coordination of care and lowering cost of care.
Representative Thompson?
Do you see...
Lights go out again.
Yeah, cause that all the time. Do you see a standardized functional role for advisory councils, relationship between them and their CCOs across the system? I know we've said every CCO will have an advisory council. I don't recall that we put any definition in there. This may be an attempt to do exactly that. But was there ever any discussion about precisely what these relationships were supposed to be? That may be the crux of what we're dealing with here. I know some of them seem to be using the advisory council a lot. Yeah. Others, I'm not sure they even recognize they have one. So it's that may be evolutionary too. But
yeah, no. So again, vice chair, chair, and vice chair, and Representative Thompson, which is likely the same person as Vice Chair Thompson.
Sometimes
I would tell you that there is some statutory requirement, like the health assessment, but much like the entire idea of flexibility, the innovation that can be created through these organizations and their committees, including the Citizen Advisory Committee, will be the success. Having them figure out what works best in their community for patient responsibility, for transportation, for whatever those needs might be that they can help bring to the table could likely be unique around the state of Oregon. I mean, things that have to happen in Portland around some of the cultural awareness and some of those different things that are very important may be somewhat different in Lakeview or Klamath Falls. So the idea is really to let them evolve. And again, that's sort of the time, I think, when I'm asking for some time to let things evolve. I think there's an opportunity here for wonderful things to come out of these community citizen advisory and laden them with actual business function, I think is detriment to what they possibly could do on the positive side.
Why don't you go to community next time?
Okay, and then Representative Conger, did you have a question? We're almost up at our deadline here.
Just quickly, I wanted to say that I actually share, I think, the authors of the bill's concern about what happens in the implementation. But at the same time, my experience, having met the Community Advisory Council board member in two CCOs and having gotten to know one of them pretty well, she is an amazing asset to that board because she has that consumer perspective, and it's working exactly as I think we had hoped. I worry that it might not in every instance. I've attended a Community Advisory Council meeting where the interaction between the consumers and the other members of the council was amazing. The consumers know things about waste that the providers don't know. They know things about their behavior and how the system works that the providers do not know, and the payer doesn't know. The former MCO, now CCO, So it is working in some cases. I do worry that there are instances where it might not be, and I don't know whether the right answer to that is to give it time, see how it shakes out, to rely on OHA to enforce. But what are your thoughts about that?
Again, thank you, Vice Chair, and Representative Conger for the question. There was a constant battle and balance between the role of not only the Citizen Advisory Council and the full board, but also Oregon Health Authority and their role in making sure that things are done properly and measuring outcomes and allowing for flexibility. I've said this at many meetings, as difficult as it was for the legislature to let go and allow communities to make some of these decisions and not do one size fit all, it's even more difficult for the health authority. I mean, their name has the word authority in it. They are historically a regulatory body, and to be innovative and allow for things to happen different parts of the state is really an endeavor for them as well as these community care organizations. So I guess my answer is I think we struck the right balance. I think it is very early in the process. Somebody mentioned earlier that some of these citizen advisory councils are still being formed and sort of finalized, and people are trying to figure out their role. I think I'd let them figure it out for a while. We're back here every year now. I mean, we're here way too much. So there's plenty of time if we need to act. The one thing I would really caution us in doing is doing a one-size-fits-all. That's what got us into the siloed one-size-fits-all system that we worked so hard to get away from. And if you do the business plan thing for everybody because you think one of them's not working right, you're right back to, again, trying to one-size-fit the system, which is very unique around the state of Oregon and very exciting when you actually take the time to listen to what the innovation that's going on and can go on with the current system.
So I'm hoping you can hold off your question for the hallway. We need to end our hearing today, and we're gonna carry House Bill 2133 over to February 15th, this Friday, and I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I would come in. It would be really nice if we could get a couple of advisory committee members to talk to us on how they think it's going. That would be very helpful.
You need to adjourn the committee.
Thank you for...
do you want to go ahead and adjourn?
I'll go ahead and adjourn. Thank you for skillfully getting us through that. We are adjourned.
Maybe my...